Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. With me today are Christian Colley and James McLean.
That was very good, wasn't it?
Thank you so much.
What do you think, James?
Are we? Yeah, it was all right, I guess.
This is all part of it, right?
You're not far off 40. I'd have kind of expected you to be able to read out a few sentences without any problems.
I was reading, right.
Even memory. I mean, we're past the time where we're told to remember the blocks at play school.
Well, I don't know. My memory these days.
Oh, what were we talking about? Yes. We're going the other way now.
So. I'm getting up there in age.
The elastic band has snapped.
That's right.
Back. Yes.
Yeah. Well, do you know, we have got certain... We've got a trio of things we want to talk about this week. But something's come up today, actually. I don't know if you guys have seen it on Casterbris. I didn't mean to mention it earlier, but I forgot. Basically, there's this painting, an oil painting by Patrick Charlton. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have.
Stunning, isn't it?
It is nice, yeah. I thought it was rather nice. I didn't know that, you always know that a lot of these actors or musicians or so on always have other talents. It's just natural. But to see something that you weren't aware of after so many years, it is kind of cool. You keep being surprised by an actor, you know, that's nice.
Well, he at some point was shy of 40. I mean, you'd think by then he'd have learned how to pick up a brush and copy a photo.
No one's getting away scot-free with you today, are they, James?
No. No, not at all. I'm feeling antagonistic.
There you go.
We can tell. Mm. So.
Terrible frame, isn't it? Really.
The frame. Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something about it which just screams a pub circa around 1986, probably in the area of the pub where they have food, and these sort of slightly yellowing walls because obviously it's still smoking at that time. Mm-hmm. Sort of cod and chips on the menu, and
chicken in a basket,
sterile.
Surely.
Possibly.
I remember I went on holiday in the early 80s with my mum and dad, and we went to a place in Somerset. We were staying on a farm. And we went out one day to a pub for a pub restaurant. I'd never been to a pub for dinner before. And I got chips in a basket. I was 6 or 7 years old. I got chips in a basket. I was quite keen on vinegar and salt. You should have seen the mess I made. Why did they serve me chips in a basket?
That was in an episode of Life on Mars too, wasn't it?
Yeah. That's what everybody complaining about it.
So why did they put them in a basket?
God, no, I have no idea. I think it was just a thing. I have really no idea. Maybe one of our listeners knows and can let us know.
I will say this.
You know,
not interested. We don't really want to know. We don't care. If we cared, we'd just go on to about.com and say, why did they put chips in a basket? And something would come up. And I'm sure it'd be a damn sight more interesting than the reply that we'd get from
Speaking
you
of Life on Mars, have either of you two seen the Russian version?
No.
I've seen the trailer for it.
I've seen the trailer, yeah. I've been looking for it in the dark sides of the internet and I haven't been able to get hold of it.
Funnily enough, today, I was just reading an hour ago, I was... About 10%. You see, this is the digital age. You can actually say quite specifically, I was 10% through the Kindle book of the fourth book of the Kindle Quartet that came out about a year ago.
Yeah. It's about Life on Mars, aren't you?
Yeah, Life on Mars. And it was the fourth one, which is called Get Cartwright. And I was just reading that just an hour ago. It's a bit freaky, really. Yeah.
Are they good books?
I didn't know there were books.
Yeah, they're only on Kindle. They are officially merchandise, officially sanctioned, and they are set directly after Life on Mars.
Who wrote them?
There is actually a big dispute or a big question of who it is, because they are written under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. And there's a pseudonym. There is actually, if you guys are interested, I'm not going to tell you, because to prove how interested you are, you'll have to actually go to either Amazon or to a Kindle, mm-hmm. and actually look at the replies on the comments for quality. Right. And there's one guy who keeps posting each one who he reckons it is and how he reckons he's found it out, and it's some established author. of some caliber that someone might know. But yeah, they're not bad. They're not bad. They're very, very, very true in the dialogue. What is interesting about them, and this is something which you can obviously apply to possibly even Doctor Who, if we wanted to tenuously link it to justify it in this podcast.
Well, they're quite linked. They're more linked than most shows.
In ways, yeah, they are. Actually in the first Kindle book, there's a large section on Doctor Who in the prologue.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Sam Tyler is such an annoying, whiny little, well, it's frankly, tosser, really. He's just a whiny little tosser. And he's written just as he is in the show, but it just shows you how your casting can actually create a more interesting personality. Because I always used to love Sam Tyler. In the book, I find him vaguely annoying. And I remember an interview with the guy who played him, his name escapes me. I think he was Doctor Who once. Yeah. And he sort of said that he found Sam Tyler a bit boring, a bit straight-laced, and obviously very dull, especially against Gene Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very true. And I didn't really see that. And I could sort of understand, as an actor playing him, how you'd look at him and you'd go, Jesus Christ, this is really actually quite a boring person to play, not realizing that how you do it imbues him with personality. In a similar way, if we go to Star Wars, Jesus, what's wrong with Doctor Who? wrong podcast. If you go to Doctor Who, you look at Mark Strickson, he said something very similar about Turlough.
Yeah, yeah.
He found that Turlough virtually had no personality by the end of it. And Stephen Pacey for Tarrant in Blake 7 made a very similar comment. But from the audience, because those actors imbue it with a personality intuitively as who they are, you see an extra dimension that they don't see, which is a kind of interesting thing. Because I think Turlough was great all the way through.
Yeah, I agree. And I was just going to say the same thing. I've actually just finished watching all of Peter Davison's era again, and I really found Turlough very cool by the end. Even, you know, in the beginning, he was a little under the Black Guardian's wing, to the point where he was just this almost like you replaced Adric the Brat with a different sort of brat. But, you know, it was a cooler character for sure. So, yeah, I have to agree. Like, Mark Strickson did a lot with him. And I remember with Life on Mars just being completely enamored with Sam Tyler. I thought he was a fantastic character. To hear that he's so boring or whiny, you say, like, by the way the books are written or by John Sims' admission, I just find it so strange. It's weird how people can perceive things like that.
But if you think of the actual dialogue that Sam has, it is very straight-laced. Mm-hmm. It is very he is very straight-laced himself. There is very little humor to him, but it doesn't come across because he plays him so well. He plays him with charm and interest. But if you take the dialogue on its own, you can see what he saw in it. And you, as I say, you can kind of see it in the book. The only real bit of his personality is his interest in Annie Cartwright. And it's a funny thing, yeah. And Strickson's brilliant. I think he's wrong as well. I think Turlough was good even near the end, after the Black Garden trilogy. He still remains very secretive and quite cowardly in some cases. Resurrection of the Daleks. He's not a gung ho hero like most companions. He just wants to get out of that space station.
So
it's interesting.
Speaking of Mark Strickson, I've noticed on the photographs of the three of us, I've been planning some publicity shots of the three of us next to each other for the podcast. I noticed that James and me have both got very similar coloured hair. So, James, you're going to have to dye yours ginger.
Dye ginger. I've had it ginger before. In the 90s, I had it ginger with a bleach stripe before Jerry Halliwell did it.
Did you?
It's quite long as well.
Okay, The Web of Fear is out on February the 24th in the UK. I'm not going to get into when it's out in the United States because BBC have probably told us the wrong date, like they did with the something that came out earlier this month and then just ends up turn into a big
sounds like a bit of a lover's tiff but
crap fight so it's out on iTunes already, and if you're on Virgin Media in the UK, which about something like 50% of people who have internet are on Virgin Media, and a large percentage of them have cable TV as well, then they can get it on demand through there. So there possibly isn't any particular reason to buy the DVD, but oh, I hear you shout, the extras! Well, there isn't any. I hear you shout, the animated episode 3! Well, they haven't animated it. What you get for episode 3 is... I'm really sorry to whoever did episode 3. It is the worst reconstruction using photos and audio that I've ever seen.
Wow.
I won't argue that. I mean, but then again, I'm no fan myself of the... the loose canon reconstructions. Yeah. I just can't watch still photos set to audio.
It is, it is difficult. You're absolutely right. It is difficult. And it is jarring as well, switching from video to a stills and audio recon and then back to video. One of the main things about that, in this case, is the audio quality of the episode is bad as well compared to the rest of the serial. And then there's this whole, and we're back into missing episodes territory now. There's this undercurrent of, hold on, have they actually found episode 3 or not? We were talking a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed that there are very strong rumours that episode 3 has been found, but not alongside this. If that's the case, then why have they not held off a bit longer? Why have they not held off to shot some extras on? Why have they not recorded at least one extra or a commentary or anything in the intervening time for the DVD release?
It is very surprising, considering we get reports, The Wheel in Space. You know, we hear this, but we don't hear anything about, The Web of Fear, which Mark Gatiss actually had already confirmed that the reason that he put the underground tunnels in episode 1 of season 3 of Sherlock was because of the found episode of The Web of Fear, which basically was confirming that The Web of Fear was found long before they told
us. Before it was announced, yeah.
A couple years before, I think it's at least 3 years going back as far as the rumors started. So it is very surprising that nothing has been done for it, aside from restoring the episodes and making the one still frame episode 3. So, yeah, I do find it very surprising that we're getting a very bare bones episode.
What do you think, James?
I don't know. I mean, I wondered, I'm totally speculative on this. I mean, it sounds almost as if someone else has been managing through Worldwide has been managing this release than who the people who would normally be managing and funding, you know, a standard BBC Doctor Who DVD release, because it feels like it's being treated as a different entity, more specifically, like you would any other TV show or film, that once you have it, you get it out while it's interesting. I mean, and even, you know, even film DVDs still run on that logic that, well, they don't come out immediately. They come out pretty damn soon after a cinema. You know, you're talking a few months, and you know, maybe within a year you'll get it out on DVD. And it feels that sort of momentum, that sort of mentality, as if it's been fast tracked, as you would any other show, rather than as Doctor Who Classic normally gets, which is a lot of time, care, and attention, because it's focused and funded in a certain way. I don't get the impression that this has been pushed through under the same mandate, and I think that's why you've got this very shoddy, half-assed, rushed release.
There is another angle too, though, which is the animated episodes. They have been saying that future animated episodes would depend on the sale of the current animated episodes. Mm-hmm. Do we think that, you know, obviously they tried to push these episodes out on iTunes first, and now they're doing bare-bone releases, basically of both of them, from what I understand. Both of these two stories are going to be bare-bone releases.
Well, the enemy of the world's complete, isn't it? So that's not as big an issue as one that has a missing episode.
Well, maybe you can buy it on iTunes, and then, you know, why buy it on DVD again if all you're getting is the same exact content? You know, and the question really in my mind is it basically because of all the rumors of all the other missing episodes, you know, they have to validate the money that they're spending to bring them back in by hopefully getting more money from the fans for buying whatever these are? Because,
well, they get an instant sale with iTunes, didn't they? They banged them on iTunes, and, you know, it was top of the charts in hours. So they were coining it in through that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm beginning to wonder, I mean, maybe this goes back to, as we were saying about the missing episodes, episode 3. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, Christian, because you've probably got a better memory than me on this. And I won't ask Brian because his memory is fading. But wasn't episode 3 one they had a couple of versions of?
Apparently there was a couple of versions of it in what we discussed a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, all speculative based on what's out there on public domain.
Yeah.
But if that's the case, it could explain why, obviously, you did get a really shoddy episode 3, because if you are going to eventually bring in episode 3 into the mix, maybe, you know, and again, I don't know, I mean, there could be lots of legal issues for this as well. I mean, you release it in the autumn as it was. Clearly, they didn't have or couldn't use, for whatever reason, because, I mean, obviously where it's coming from, how it's being brought in, how it's being bought, you know, it could be a totally different legal situation. So it couldn't be put in with that. So when you do release that as well, you're going to not want to have done an animated episode maybe it is held back because they know they are going to re-release it in the future. So,
See, that's the thing. I definitely assume that they're going to go for a special edition release, cause, especially since I haven't done any extras alone that would warrant to me a special edition release. I guess, you know, for me, episode 3, like you said, the audio quality was lesser. And that makes sense to me because the only existing audio is what was recorded off air. So you're not going to have the audio quality be as good as the rest of the episodes when all you have is the off air recording, you know, somebody having a microphone hooked up to a TV, you know. But if they do have the extra episode, if they have a couple of choices of the extra episode, and they, because correct me if I'm wrong, the release date for this was pushed back in the UK.
Yeah, right? I think it was.
The DVD. Yeah. So what's the deal of pushing it back if you're only going to give us exactly what you were going to give us anyway? Was that like glimmer of hope and maybe the restoration on whatever?
I think it was a glimmer of hope for.
Great.
I think it was a glimmer of hope for fans. What the actual truth behind it was, I don't know. Maybe it was just.
But then, you know, stuff does get pushed back, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Depending on our publication, legals, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think basically you can just take from this that it's capitalizing on a fast release. And maybe also, I don't know how BBC Worldwide actually runs the DVD releases, how they are funded, how they are slotted and measured through. You know, if you've got a load already tied up with money put forward for restorations and features and everything, but you want to get this out fast because at the moment, you know, you've got want to capitalize on the money that could be made. You know, you can't slot it in there to suddenly be given features and everything. Maybe that's already budgeted and funded for the others. Mm-hmm. So that won't come out till later. But rather wait to the back of this year when, you know, the release has gone cold, get it out now. And then, as you say, do a special edition later. I think it probably is a mixture of commercial reasons and practical reasons. But yeah, the fact they've done nothing for it would suggest that they will plan to do something for it later.
Yeah.
I've got a... go on, mate.
I was just going to say, I will say, I know so many fans who right now they're not really caring that it's a bare bones release. They want a DVD to put on the shelf to complete their DVD collection with. And I understand that. Like I personally bought them on iTunes, and I have a feeling I'm going to buy them on DVD when they get here, too. If nothing else, to do my part, because if what they are hoping is that the sales are warranting doing more releases later, then I want to help with that, essentially. Yeah.
I agree. Agree, maybe not wholeheartedly, but I totally sympathize. I've got a copy of Dalek Invasion of Earth, which I didn't buy. I got it free with a newspaper. And it, to all intents and purposes, it looks like the actual DVD, but there's no extras on it. And that sits on my shelf. We polled the Castorbis readers yesterday. That was Sunday. We're recording this on Monday. You'll probably hear this on Thursday or Friday if you're freshen up for it. 48% wanted to see the missing episodes ASAP and they're buying the DVD version. 22% have already seen it on iTunes and Virgin Media and they're still going to buy it. Significantly, 16.6% are waiting for the full recovered serial to be released.
That's me.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That's interesting. I hope they don't do this in future. I mean, hopefully, if they're going to release any more on iTunes, then they'll be able to formalize some sort of structured approach to it in future. Once this is sorted out, the whole Omni-Rumor thing. If there is an Omni-Rumor, if it's all real, if it can get sorted out, then hopefully they will sort it out and then introduce some sort of structure to it.
It takes me back, though, to the Wheel in Space thing with Wendy Padbury. If she really did record a commentary like she supposedly says anyway, then if that DVD were to really come out with nothing on it, then that would seem very wrong. You know, I guess I can kind of understand if somehow they've had these releases for a couple years, or maybe they've been known about for a couple years and they were trying to clean them up. And when, you know, to quell all of us out here in rumor land, they gave us those two stories straight away before they got to do anything special for them. For whatever reason, choose those two. I don't know. Maybe because they were two of the heavy heavy ones in the rumor mill. Then I guess I can get behind that. But if Wendy Padbury says there's a commentary for this thing that she did, and that DVD comes out and there's no commentary, then it's going to seem like there's a trend of get as much money as we can by releasing these things twice. And I don't want to see that trend go.
So it was a brilliant marketing ploy. I mean, if they did have more than they do than the two, you released two, what was it, like a month or so? a month before the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that gives your whole Doctor Who platform, which you are sort of running on, I wouldn't say it was a dicey, but an unprecedented international platform. You're really sparking further interest in as well as making money. when the show, you want to really be piquing the show's interest. So I could see that you released two, not to placate fans, but to give to capitalize on the 50th, which, as I say, might sound very cold-hearted, but is something, you know, which corporations and businesses have to do. And in a sense that it helps the fans as well, because it helps push the media interest in Doctor Who for that very vital year. So I would imagine that's probably very true. I think it's a fascinating situation. It's a fascinating, it'll be interesting in a couple of years, provided we've not died of old age by then, Brian, to find out what the people involved actually, what was going on, because then we'll probably find out how this whole thing, probably through Kavanagh and his damn warp and all his great stories. He'll run the expose on it all, and I reckon it'll be very fascinating if he does.
Do you think there's any merit to maybe that these episodes clearly weren't ready to be given to us yet, and while it was to kind of cash in on the 50th and get people excited, it may have also been a way to try and get people off of the 50th for the moment, like the actual episode itself, you know, to keep spoilers and rumors for that.
It's difficult to say, because the quality, in particular in Web of Fear, the quality of the video segments is astonishingly good.
Yeah.
So, listener, there's a switch between film books interior and then video interior. So a lot of the tube sets are shot on film, and then some of the more closer bits in the tube sets, and there's sort of like the underground base, they're shot on video, and the video quality is really crisp. So I mean, were they like maintained like that over the years? Were they recorded like that? I doubt they recorded like that off the TV. It clearly wasn't recorded off the TV. So how much remastering has gone into it?
Well, if they've had them for some time, and I don't think it would have been a short-term decision, as people think, that suddenly it had been part of the year's programme. I don't think it's anything to do with BBC Cardiff. I don't think BBC Cardiff's reach extends so far as worldwide, which is quite a monster empire in itself.
Yeah.
I think obviously there would be talks and understandings, but I don't think it would be done to help Doctor Who. But I think it would be a logical move by the people who obviously deal with Doctor Who on worldwide and the BBC to see if they could get something out. I mean, you could also argue, and again, I think this is extremely speculative, but with the 50th year dealing so heavily with the consciousness from the Web of Fear and obviously the Abominable Snowman as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, was that deliberate as well to pick an enemy that would tally with the missing episode?
I agree. Yeah, I mean,
going to be the return of Salamander through the time vortex, was it?
No, that would have been curious. Michael Troughton getting another role.
Okay, we'll push on then onto Big Finish. Before we go anywhere else with Big Finish, we're going to talk about some of the highlights of this year's range. But they've, of course, won an award with Dark Eyes.
Oh, brilliant. Yesterday. Good on them.
Yeah, brilliant news. We got this. I don't have the full details of this because I sent it away for one of the excellent Castover's news team to write up as one of today's assignments. It may have been Phil. If it was Phil, it's possibly been written by now, in which case it shouldn't take too long. He's very efficient, this Phil. I sometimes think he's some sort of android. He's like Saladin.
Android isn't that efficient. My Kindle's okay, I guess, but
no, not that type of Android. An actual Android. He's like an actual Android.
Well, like C-3PO. He wasn't very efficient. He was efficient.
No, I was thinking more Saladin.
He's saying Android, like that host of that TV show in the future. Bad Wolf, you know, Android, that one. She's like, he's got robotic red hair, so you don't need to be the ginger anymore.
No. She was vaguely efficient, but she didn't have any arms, so she couldn't type it up.
No, I didn't mean her either.
Okay.
Big Finish, Dark Eyes. Congratulations to the Big Finish team and to the cast, Paul McGann and the lady whose name completely escapes me at the moment. Maybe Brian can help me out there, who played Molly.
The Molly girl.
The Molly Girl, yes.
Oh, I am ashamed to say I can't help you. Yeah, it's not here on the tip of my tongue. But if
never
we
mind.
Do the magic of editing, I can pretend like I knew after I look it up.
Well, I mean, I'm going to wait on this. I mean, it's actually a very good price at the moment of £20, as I recall. They're doing it for the whole four. All four parts on Big Finish, which is a great deal. But I kind of wanted to wait till they accidentally deleted them. And then 30 years later, they recovered as missing episodes, released bare bones, where I will ignore them and then wait for the full release.
Ahead.
No, well, yeah, but it will have to be all the full special features that will happen a year later to my head. To my floating brain in a Marmite jar.
So it was the BBC Audio Drama Awards, and Doctor Who Dark Eyes, A Great War, was up for Best Online or Non-Broadcast Drama. It's been broadcast since, though, I think, hasn't it?
Has it?
I think it was broadcast over Christmas, wasn't it?
Don't think Dark Eyes was. No, isn't they did the stuff before it.
Did they? Oh, right, okay. My mistake. So, no doubt it'll end up on the radio. It's excellent. I don't know why more of it doesn't go straight to radio, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was just going to say that myself.
So, well done, everyone. Paul McGann, the Big Finish team, Nick Briggs and Dave Richards and Richardson and Jason Hallery. Brilliant. Great work. And we're getting more Dark Eyes as well, aren't we? So that's good news, too. Anything with Paul McGann is good news, to be honest with you. Now then, this year, Big Finish have got a vast selection of things for you to listen to. We compiled a nice kind of list of it earlier this month. In fact, it was just a few days ago. And, you know, we've got the Fourth Doctor Adventures, which that's for another day. We've got Colin Baker, and we've got Peter Davison, and we've got Sylvester McCoy. I'm particularly interested in the Seventh Doctor stuff. That's standing out to me as some interesting things. There's also the return of the Nucleus of the Swarm from The Invisible Enemy. In a series called The Revenge of the Swarm. You've obviously looked at the page I'm talking about, or you're aware of some of what's coming with Big Finish this year. Anything standing out for you?
I am honestly just the thing I'm looking forward to the most is the next Dark Eye series. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy the Tom Baker series. The last few ones have been fun, but I guess the best way to say it is when Big Finish first started, they were very enjoyable, but it did take a little while for some of the Doctors to find their legs again playing the Doctor, and I think that happened with Tom Baker. Whereas with Paul McGann, it's just every story with him is on for me. You know, I just feel they're great, and you know, it's just always nice getting a new story from him. In a sense, for me, is like he's still the current Doctor, and I think that's just why I look forward to those the most.
You're so
really
1990s.
I know, but they're so good. But not to downplay Tom Baker, I really enjoy them. I actually just downloaded the latest one, so I think I'm actually going to start that one today. But yeah, the one I'm looking forward to the most, probably also because he seems to be the Doctor that they use a bit more sparingly anymore. He's not in the regular rotation, Paul McGann.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to really wait for his story. So that's probably another reason why I'm really looking forward to those.
Hey, James?
Well, yeah, there's, I mean, I was looking at the stuff they had coming for the year. I mean, there's more stuff with McCoy, I think, is interesting. I mean, what they're doing with, I've not heard the most recent ones with, you know, I'm not hoping, not giving anything away with the loss of Hex, which seems to imply later on that he might reappear in the year. I'm not sure, which is quite interesting because I've grown to quite like that character. I wasn't sure I would. But he works. I think at the end of the year, which at the moment, as I recall, is actually more of an offer for subscribers, which is always deeply frustrating because, as I said many times before, I don't really have the money to be ploughing into subscription. But they've got the Valiard one, haven't they, further on at the back end of 2014, which I think is rather an exciting idea. I think at the moment it's running as a subscription offer. I could be wrong there. But
No, you're right. That's out
yeah,
now.
It's out.
Yeah, it's out.
It's out because they must have done a typo, because when I saw it, it said something like Christmas 2014. Oh, good Lord, that's a long time to
no, actually. Christmas 2014 is when it'll go on. What they usually do with the free subscriber stories there, it's like, for instance, this one is now out for Christmas,
it's out
so
now.
It's free, but 2014, they'll sell it to people.
They'll sell it. I got you. Yeah. Oh, that's a good deal.
Is this the
Trial of the Valiard, I believe.
Trial of
the
Valiard,
Trial of the Valiard, yes, which I think is a very interesting, especially because apart from Craig Hinton's unofficial time champion, novel, which was done posthumously, wasn't it? Then the Van Eld's been something that no one's been able to touch. In fact, it was quite surprising they even made a mention to it in this year's Doctor Who, just a passing mention to his name, because he's been a blacklisted from everything for a long time.
Except Gustavus Magazine.
Except Gustavus Magazine, where, yes, he sits like a bitter old man.
Being bitchy.
As a typewriter, being, yes, bitchy, yeah. So aside from that, he's very quiet. So it's great that they've got him for that. And I think it's nice to see Big Finish again having a little opportunity to play a little with continuity. Not that they don't do that enough as it is. But, yes, there seems to be a lot of Sylvester and Colin stuff this year, as I recall, which is...
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
I will say I did hear the first Hex story of the year pertaining to, like you said, his death. And that was a very good story, actually. And I hear very good things about the Valeyard story, but I haven't started it myself yet. So I do think you have a couple of really good things to look forward to there, both James and the listener of this, because I think when it comes to Big Finish, the stories that I always enjoy the most, and not to downplay other doctors, because Big Finish really tell very good stories and all the doctors are really good at it, as well as all the characters. But the stories I generally enjoy the most are the Sylvester and the Paul McGann stories. They just do a lot of really good stuff with Sylvester. And I agree with you, James, that Hex works really well. And certainly they use Ace very well. So they're always a good listen.
And there's also worth mentioning on Big Finish's front, because they've actually stopped printing their very early stuff, you can get them for some very nice prices on download from Big Finish. Yesterday I was just looking, and because I've still not heard Spare Parts, actually, which is, for people who don't know, is one of the early Peter Davison's, which was was in some ways considered a platform for Rise of the Cybermen. And they've also got Jubilee, which was Rob Shimmons initial idea for Dalek in Big Finish form, and they're very, very cheap. As I say, some like £2.99 I think or £5 on download. They're really good prices,
and they're well worth it too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some really good Zagreus, which we've talked about recently. All the stuff that they're actually no longer doing CD prints of, they've got for very good bargain prices on download. So it's really worth supporting them, because as I've said before, I don't think they're an organization which makes, you know, people think they make loads and loads of cash. I don't get the impression they do. I don't mean that in a nasty way. I mean, it's not, you know, it's something which requires fans to support to keep the quality and at the range alive. I don't think it should be something that we should just rest on our laurels and just assume, if you see what I mean. I'm not saying that they're poor or that, you know, they don't pay their actors, and I'm not saying that at all. Just saying I think it's something that we need to support if you want to and not just presume that it just carries on without fans having to indulge a little. So yeah, please support them.
Okay. Right. Yeah, couldn't agree more. You may or may not know this, dear listener, and you may be one of those listeners that are new to Casterbus in the podcast, or you might be one of our longest lasting. You might be our original reader. No, you won't be. That's Brian. But the thing is, you might have been on Casterbus for a long time, reading posts and everything. You may not have noticed the fact that we've got a forum. It's a funny thing, running a forum. Over the last few months, I've tried to make it a bit more prominent on the website, and that's having a good effect at the moment. And so much so that I think what we're doing today is bringing a topic out of the forum and into the podcast, which is something we haven't really tried before. Essentially, what the topic is about Cybermen and how they have changed over the years. It doesn't have to be just Cybermen, though. It could be any monsters. The original post is by Tony S. He says, in the moon base, Polly sees a Cyberman and immediately recognizes it as a Cyberman, yet the appearance is radically different to the 10th planet. It looks just like a robot. So how does she recognize it? Now, it seems to me that the reason she recognizes it is because within the narrative, the creatures in Antarctica and on the moon are identical to Polly. What she saw in the 10th planet is the same as the creatures she sees in the shadows on the moon base, on the moon base. So what I want to just throw it open to the guys and find out if they agree with that's what's going on, and how, and then we'll go on to sort of like how this has affected Doctor Who in a more sort of like long lasting sort of way. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's the case or not?
I actually do. I think the way the story was written, they probably didn't originally think about a complete redesign when it was writing, or, you know, just the redesign that it was. So I think that's a very valid point. But I do think also within the story, there's enough for her to go by to reasonably assume it could be them. But it is also at the same time a little bit of a leap of faith to kind of just jump to that conclusion. But it does seem very likely that it was written that they were supposed to be identical. But by that, I mean that the story would have used the actual 10th planet Cybermen originally in the writing stages.
Yeah, sure, sure. What about you, James?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't think there's anything I could disagree with Brian there. I mean, obviously, yeah, I think as so far as the story went, there was no assumption there'd be a massive redesign. But then at the same time, you know, you meet a Nazi in a grey uniform, you meet a Nazi in a black uniform, you would still say it's a Nazi. The handles are still there, the middle, you know, the middle front is still there. They are robotic. She's not actually been inundated with a plethora of cyborgs or robots, as I recall in her run, to actually assume that it's just oh my God, it's just another new race of robots. You could quite naturally assume it's a Cyberman. Also, the fact we only get the visual sense, you know, you don't know, there could be a certain smell to Cybermen. I know that sounds silly, but they could. I never thought about, do they smell oily? I mean, obviously, you know, they.
Well, they might smell of. You know, electric motors.
Exactly. There could be something.
Sorry, an ozone-y smell, yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, this is where the situation does become blurry, is that you get the issue where you've got Tomb of the Cybermen and you take Attack of the Cybermen, where there's a very strong inference that they are the same Cybermen, same cyber leader, even though obviously the redesign of the 80s has taken into a far different look.
Yeah.
So it is something which, you know, actually the issues of production and narrative do blur somewhat. But yeah, I think you can get it away. I mean,
do you find that jarring?
Yeah, I do a bit. Yeah. I must admit, I find my brain tries to reconcile reasons for it. And I must admit, one of the reasons is that I don't watch many Colin Bakers. That solves that problem. All done. No worries there. Now, it's a story I've not seen in ages, I must admit, to be fair. But yeah, we do try and reconcile these issues, don't we?
Mm. Yeah. Well, the other side of it as well is there's a cultural difference between the Cybermen in the 10th planet and those in the moon base.
Right, yeah.
So the Cybermen in the 10th planet all have names.
Yeah.
From the moon base onwards, they have no individuality at all. So they're a lot chattier as well, although Revenge of the Cybermen certainly gives them a run for their money. So this is something that happens behind the scenes. This is how it updates to the Cyberman's look, and then it sort of becomes part of Doctor Who.
Yeah,
that's kind of strange in a way, I think. That something that happens for production, it's not unique, but it's interesting that it should happen in that kind of a way, which then takes us back to Attack of the Cybermen.
Right. Attack of the Cybermen, I actually have a bit more of an issue with, I guess, because if they were going to take it back to 1985, I think instead of what they were trying to do was still upgrade again, still enhance the Cybermen, still make them look a little bit more new and threatening. But they were going back to that classic time. They should have used those classic Cybermen. And it's something that I think, you know, you would do very easily in a book, very easily in a movie, you know, or certainly if you remembered the aspects of time travel, you'd want to keep those things in mind. So I take a little bit more issue with that. I think seeing them in the moon base, they do evolve. And I think if I'm not mistaken, in the moon base, the Cybermen may even mention the 10th planet situation. But how much time has passed since then? I think much more like James said, you know, with his uniform recognition, it makes a lot more sense that Polly just recognizes what she recognizes and doesn't feel that there's any kind of fault in jumping to the conclusion that they are a Cybermen.
And plus, but, people do that. People do sometimes jump to conclusions, and she could have been wrong. The doctor say, oh, no, these may look like Cybermen, but they're totally different.
These are Cyberons.
Yes, these are androids. And from the future, who write articles.
There's also the other thing is that Rose recognized the Cybermen in Rise of the Cybermen just based on the head that she saw in Van Staten's museum. Yeah, and no, they were different. They just had the handles, you know.
To be fair to Attack, I mean, obviously the reason that they are like that is budgetary. They've got the same Cybermen essentially that they've been using through the 80s. They do some very minor modifications. It's, you know, to actually order in a brand new set of clothing, which is actually has to be based and duplicated from, you know, something which is no longer in stock. You can see why they just
they could have maybe given this story another edit and cropped it down a bit and got rid of some of the guest actors.
Well, let's see, you could argue that, but the point being, especially in the 80s, the argument would be, and Russell would probably have this argument if his funding and fandom side of him wasn't so big, that in the end the majority of people will not remember what they look like in the 80s, if they even remember, sorry, in the 60s, if even they remember the 60s episode, which again brings a question.
Well, of course they don't remember. They won't remember the 60s, because if they do remember, they weren't there.
Oh, absolutely, exactly. Very, very, very good. That's a particularly a nice tabloidness.
That's a very true point, though. I mean, obviously they
thank you
that people wouldn't not you that people wouldn't remember the 60s Cybermen, and I get that, and that makes sense for the time. It's just that I think if they were to try and do a story now, going back to the Cybermen then, I don't think that we would get an exact representation of the 10th Planet Cybermen. I think we would get an approximation of what they looked like, because even now they would still try to want to make them look a little bit more real and less hokey or whatever. But I do think for something like Attack, if the BBC actually had costume archives, if they had access to the masks and the suits from those eras, it would have been interesting to at least see in some of the tombs some of those Cybermen bodies in there the way that they used to look, even if they were going to keep the more modern Cybermen being the main baddies of the story. I mean, it could have even been written into the story, you know, like I'm trying to remember exactly what happens in Attack now. As much as I've seen it, I can't remember if the Cybermen were kind of also doing a time travel thing of their own, or if they were all meant to be the Cybermen from 1985. But it would have been interesting to see some of the older ones in the tombs, like particularly when the Doctor removed the faceplate to get the recall unit out of the one's head. Would have been interesting to see an older design there rather than the more modern.
But there's a certain element of your audience consumption and of their expectations. And in the 80s, there was no expectations to that level of detail. I mean, the problem with Attack is that you're doing something which most people won't remember, so you have to argue why you're bothering to do it in the first place is one perhaps thing. You know, fandom wasn't as it is now. And then you can't do it well. I mean, take the two Doctors, where they do a very, very rough, pretty daft version of an older version of the console room for the second Doctor, which is basically the old Legopolis top with a really crappy base on it. And it's a vague attempt, but it's not seriously done. But I know what you mean. These days they try and tart it up, but I mean, when they can, because audiences have changed now and audiences have come to a point where they do expect a certain amount of a certain amount of clarity to the era that you're poking at, they do work a lot harder. I mean, even if you take like the battle scene recently in Day of the Doctor, where you have all those TARDISes heading towards the camera. Now, some of them weren't right. They used a stock version of the current TARDIS for Hartnell's. But then you had very quite close props. You had a Newbery there. You had one of the Brax was there as well. They'd obviously checked the designs and were basing it on the props of that time. So you're very clearly saying the prop does change in the same way that now they acknowledge that the console room changes. You didn't get that until this new series, really. That only really started in the New Adventures books that they were written by fans. And this is why we get this change, is because so much of television today is written by fans of television. So it's not just so much about the audience consumption expecting close approximations to previous stuff. It's people doing it want to do it as well. And there's a very fascinating article, actually, again, going off Doctor Who, I was reading about James Bond, and the guy who the director of Die Another Day was really keen to try and get Sean Connery in it to emphasize this long running theory that James Bond is a code name rather than an actual person. And obviously people obviously squawk at that and say, well, that's ridiculous because, you know, he's I think we've talked about this before, you know, he's had a wife and they've different versions have made acknowledgement to this wife. Sure, and yet at the same time you say, well, yeah, but at the same time we go, right, that makes it far more rational than it is the same person who remains identically approximate same age while the rest of the cast ages over 30 years. That's far, yes, that makes sense. So you can see what I mean. But then that is what I mean. It's about people taking a longer franchise and looking inwards. And that is the beauty of what we have now, isn't it? Is we have the inward, we have the whole desktop theme joke. And that is part of it. While until the 80s, that wasn't part of it. In a sense, in the 80s, you could almost get the impression that the TARDIS was meant to be the same as it was in the 60s, that it was meant to be the same in, you know, within the fiction. And it's only that the actual props have updated. And the only thing that goes against that is the Five Doctors, where one, you get him where he actually clearly says he's just updated the console room. And two, as I've said, I think before, when Susan enters the console room, you get the impression the way the actress plays it is that it's not quite the console room that she's expecting. Yeah.
You also get that earlier, though. You get that in the Mask of Mandragora when the Doctor finds a secondary console room.
That's true.
One of their first explanations, like the console room itself didn't change. There were multiples. But then, of course, when you get to the Five Doctors, they talk about that he did a refit of it, and both seem plausible to me. And at the same time, I don't mind the idea that Moffat put forward of the desktop theme. I don't mind that it can be changed that way because it's alien technology. It seems to me that Russell's vision was very much what Peter Davison did, which was refit the console room, except over however many years of traveling, he just fixed that console room up as best he could. Moffat made up the desktop theme, but he also made up that the TARDIS itself can regenerate. So it seems like there's multiple ideas for the console room, which I think are all very valid and all at the same time can be true. But you're right. It does seem like for years they tried to just, for instance, when Pertwee got his new console after Inferno, when they used the original one for the last time, he got a new one and they never really mentioned, hey, look, I did this up. They just started using a new console and they changed the walls multiple times. They even had him in the living room setting, which lends itself very well to the desktop theme idea. But you're right. They didn't address it.
They do, don't they, a little. Doesn't Jo Grant at one point come in something like the Time Monster, isn't it? She walks in and says it's different in here because they've got a slide, because they've got the dishes on the wall by that point. And she's obviously noticed.
He's going to do some serious cake making. Yes,
exactly. Weren't they sink basins or something like that?
They look like something wok, like but yeah. Whatever they are.
He's going to local Chinese.
Furious. Yes, furious finding all their woks have disappeared. And now.
It is funny, though, in his era, how much they changed it on him. Like almost like every episode, they'd go, hey, here we do. You know what? No, that was crap. Let's do another one for the next. No, that's crap, too. Like, they just couldn't get it right.
It warps or something, didn't it? The one with the bowls.
Yeah.
I had to replace it.
Well, they did the same thing with Tom Baker's, the one that came in, and the wood one, the wood panel one.
Yeah.
They loved it. They were going to continue using it, but they improperly stored it over the summer in between the seasons, and it warped, and it was ruined. So they had to go back and use the old console room.
I got the impression more recently that that's been sort of made out to be a slightly apocryphal, that there was an intention to go back to the white one anyway. I don't know if that's true. I remember someone reading that.
I don't know. I only know. I mean, I'd have to go back and read some of the books.
Yeah, I've heard your.
It does seem to make sense because when you go back to the white console room, they did it first in Planet of Evil. Mm. And then you see it again in Pyramids of Mars. But then you don't really ever see that again.
Yeah,
that's the old Pertwee console. And they're using the walls that are the large holes in the wall rather than the roundels that we've come to know later on in Tom Baker's era. So if they were intentionally going back to that room, why use a set that was an old set for just two stories?
It does
lend more weight to me.
It has to be accurate. The actual console for Planet of Evil was actually brand new. They rebuilt it. Apparently, what I read, and if you actually look at the actual shape and everything, it is different. They rebuilt it for that year season, and they used the walls are the same as a Time Monster without dishes, without the woks, but it's got the same. You even got the master wall. The master's entrance. In Time Monster, which is on the other side, actually becomes the entrance which Sarah Jane comes twirling out in the Victoria dress. It's there painted with a bit of blue.
It's been rebuilt. I will say that I'm a little surprised by that because my friend's thinking about building a console, and he was looking at that particular one from Pyramids of Mars. And I told him that it looked to me like the one that Pertwee used, just they painted it white. But when you go to Planet of Evil, it's actually more the greenish color that Pertwee used. They only painted it white by Pyramids of Mars. And it does seem to look like the screen caps that I've taken of the one that Pertwee used. It doesn't seem like it actually was rebuilt to me. They rebuilt maybe the central rotor because that's different. It's green to red.
We've mentioned it before. There's a great website out there. Maybe we should link to it in the show notes. Mind Robber, where he does quite a intense anal history of the consoles, and I'm pretty sure there he reckons that it was actually rebuilt for pyramids. And I think that was then reused. That one became the basis of the wand when it comes back in Invisible Enemy. And
so it's Pertwee's in Planet of Evil, but they rebuilt it for pyramids.
No, I think the Planet of Evil, I think it is the same console, probably slightly touched up for between Pyramids and Planet of Evil. But then
yeah,
that carries on. But,
yeah.
I know another set designer who seems to infer that it is the same one pretty much all the way through with just real heavy rebuilds. It's the same.
That's very likely to me. That.
The thing about the brown console, of course, the secondary console room, is that it must have had a lot less in terms of maintenance. Because all you've got is just, you've got a little... essentially a six-sided writer's bureau with some lit switches inside it. There's no time column going up and down.
But that makes
it needs to be plugged in. There's no, there's none of that going on. There's no, I think if they'd have stuck with it, we would consider the white console room to be nothing more than a kind of a 1960s curio, I reckon.
Yes, probably quite possibly. I mean, it's funny in a sense. You look at the when we go into the 90s and we've got McGann's, there's as much homage really to the actual vibe of the secondary as there is to the original with the shape of the actual console. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think it would have been quite interesting to see where that could have gone. It's funny with the consoles. I mean, we know we've talked about consoles before, but just going back to Day of the Doctor, and one of the sad things about Day of the Doctor, and again, it goes down to productions and time and everything else, so I'm not blaming them for it. But one of the things that the designers would say when they built the Eccleston console rooms, they wanted a console which looked like it's sort of gone through its paces, it's been through a war. And of course, by the end of Day of the Doctor, he's still in the sort of miniaturized, you know, the roundel and TARDIS fusion, new TARDIS fusion. So... it, you know, the TARDIS that we see Eccleston has, while it looks quite old and battered, more so than Hertz did, it didn't go through any war now, because obviously, as I say, Hertz, and it's a shame in a sense that, and I say not blaming Moffat at all for it, because it's just the way, you know, you can't let tiny things.
I would have
like
liked
that.
To see the Eighth Doctor's TARDIS recreated in there, and you might say, oh, that would have cost a bit, but it wouldn't, because they were going in that direction with the Lodger, with those struts around the TARDIS.
And they could have easily, there's a guy in California who actually owns the TV movie console.
Yeah.
And he actually just spent an age and a day restoring it back to its proper glory. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm sure had the BBC said, hey, can we use this? I guarantee you he would have said, no problem. Shipping it over there, maybe not, but shipping the actors here could have been a possibility. But yeah, I agree. That would have been a neat thing to see, to have seen either he or Hurt at that console. I do want to say, though, before we get too far from it, since we keep bouncing back and forth with consoles, the wood paneled console room having deteriorated the way they said, or not deteriorated, but warped from heat, is the story that I heard. Like you said, could be true, could be one of those ones that's just floating around that's never going away. I do know that the actual walls to the original console room, the one that they used in the Baker and Davison years, by the time they got to the McCoy era, they had deteriorated so badly that for one story they had to use a curtain that had roundels printed on it. So, you know, it is a wonder. It does make you wonder how they store these things or what their upkeep was, because they used those walls and that console for quite a few years. And that was the other thing. They were actually going to design that other console for Sylvester McCoy for the Series 27 had that happened. Mm. Which was quite an interesting design, because it would have been a console suspended by the central rotor. There would have been no base to it.
Yeah.
So that would have been interesting. It's there's a lot of things that's kind of really sad that we didn't get to see, especially even when you're looking at some of the redesigns of the console room for Matt Smith. There were some really, really cool designs in there.
I suppose one other one when we're talking about this, about redesigns of monsters, because as you say, we've gone a bit off beaten track. I noticed that there's on the Kindle, they've got new covers for some of the older stories
which
they're reissuing, and they've got one for the Solarians, which is
I haven't seen that one. I've seen the Robots of Death.
Corpse Marker. Yes, that's what actually drew me in, strange enough. It's a good story that I remember reading that. But there's one for the Third Doctor, and the front cover, the image they use, is Silurian from the new series.
Right.
And the same for, they use Dan Starkey's Sontaran for one of the Sontaran stories as well. And again, you've got this sort of, is that an intention? I mean, obviously it's marketing, But it sort of blurs the line again when you've got things like the Silurians, which and to be fair, the Ice Warriors, obviously, again, are slightly different. But then the Ice Warriors have been very different in each one. Having watched the Ice Warriors recently, I mean, you've obviously got the Ice Warriors, the original, is quite interesting in the sense that you've got some really odd looking Ice Warriors, which from what I understand from the commentary was the original design, which they then realized was too cumbersome for the main Ice Warrior actors. So they changed the headgears so you could see the mouth and everything. Right. So you get some very unusual designs of Cybermen in there with massive heads, and their guns are different as well. So they're very different to even the Seeds of Death. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of good. I'm kind of glad that we have these disparities, because it does mean it gives you something to play on and to talk about. And it even gives people like, you know, the writers. I mean, Stephen Moffat went on saying these Silurians was a different breed of Silurians to the ones that are in now.
I can handle that, but I would like to see the old ones again.
Yeah, so would I. I mean, I think we all would, wouldn't we? I think we'd all, I mean, everyone's dying to see an old Cyberman, and I think they're probably going to have to do that at some point, because the new lot just haven't really been, I don't think they've been quite as effective.
I would really like them to play with the whole, that Seventh Doctor and Ace illegal alien story, The Missing Adventure, which is set in World War II, where there's a Cyberman going around murdering people. And it's a called the Limehouse Lurker. And it's a Cyberman that got caught in a bomb blast during the Blitz.
That's a good idea. I haven't read Illegal Alien, so...
It's one of the better Missing Adventures. It's one of my favourite from the entire range of spin-off books. It's a really good read. And it's got a nice kind... It's got a nice... without spoiling anything, it's got an ending which is not too far removed from Invasion of the Dinosaurs. It's very good. I like it. Which, funny enough, that brings us to recommendations.
Right.
Good.
Unless anyone had anything else to say on the issue of revamping monsters on TARDIS consoles.
The only thing I was going to say there was I just recently watched Warriors of the Deep. And, you know, it was another case of revamping the monsters that were supposed to be the same, because the one leader, Iktar, I think it was, of the Silurians, was supposed to be the same one that John Pertwee had met in the Silurians.
Yeah.
But the design was very different, especially they're wearing armor, but also the look was different. Even the way they moved was different. They made them walk slower and different and talk different. So, yeah, I mean, I'm all for things evolving. I think it's very cool. I think certainly for Cybermen and Daleks, it's always been a great treat until the candy coated Daleks. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there that, you know, it was another thing that was kind of weird, especially since it was the same one and not a different breed, like what Moffat did or what they even did with the Sea Devils, making them a different breed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and you've got that as well with the Cybermen. I mean, there's a strain of arguments that's long gone around. And I know David Banks capitalized on it. We've talked about it before. Sure, Cybermen actually being different cyber races. They're being cyber nomads and the ones of the cyber wars. And you used to say go to David Banks, who wrote a book and actually chronologically created a legacy for all these different cyber versions and how they all interact with each other. And it can all be very interesting. And in a sense, it's funny how inconsistencies brought by production and time can actually, in some ways, actually enrich the stuff that you actually enjoy, because it does give different levels, even if the levels are unspoken. And sometimes not sort of capitalized on in the most commercial veins like the TV show, but become part of the actual books and the audios, which have got more space to enjoy playing with these little treats as they become.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So recommendations. Who wants to start recommendations this week?
I'm all set with mine if you want.
Okay, then you go for it, Brian.
Okay. I have finished a couple first seasons of TV shows recently, and I really want to recommend all of them because they were all really fun.
What shows were they, Brian? Good.
First one was Ripper Street.
Yeah,
that was a very good show. I don't have series 2 here yet. It's not out here on Netflix for me to watch it yet, but I'm really very much looking forward to it, although I heard it was canceled, which bums me out.
Don't worry too much about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
The other one is Copper, which was the original series by BBC America, which originally I was a bit hesitant to start. But actually, after watching Ripper Street, I kind of felt for something in that kind of period vein. And I thought, you know what, Copper might be the right thing. And I'll say there's a bit of a couple character traits or storylines, plot lines that kind of are very similar in both series. And I don't know if that was because Copper was in some way influenced by Ripper Street or not, but they're very different series on their own right otherwise, and they're both very good. So I finished series one of both of those. And also, because I am a fan of some of these cop dramas or murder mysteries that you guys have, I finished the first series of Endeavor, and I really liked that a lot too. It's slower paced than the other two. It's not in the same kind of storytelling vein. It's very much like Inspector Lewis or Midsummer Murders, but it's a really well-told story, really well-told murder mysteries and character development for Morse. So I would recommend those three because they were a heck of a lot of fun to watch.
Okay. Well, we're on the topic of murder series. Did anyone catch Michelle Ryan and Peter Davison in Death in Paradise last week?
No.
No.
Yeah. Didn't. Peter Davison was particularly good. Michelle Ryan was... Michelle Ryan. Well, Peter Davison was good. He was sort of an embittered screenwriter. Very, very good.
Which almost sort of tallies with his Five-ish Doctors, where he comes across as an embittered screenwriter.
Well, we all know he's a much better actor than the embittered screenwriter, don't we? Because, we've seen Doctor Who, we've seen All Creatures Great and Small, we've seen the other things that he's done. He was very entertaining, especially his face when he discovered who the murderer was, because he really hated her. Have either of you, were you watchers of Death in Paradise before?
No.
Because I haven't heard of it.
All right, okay. Well, previously it was Ben Miller Armstrong and Miller as the lead character who gets uprooted and sent to the Caribbean to be a policeman. He's a policeman to start off with, and he decided he didn't want to spend half of the year in the Caribbean anymore, which was one of the reasons why we suspected he might have been cast as the 12th Doctor, or seriously be up for it, because there didn't seem to be any real sensible reason why anyone would not want to spend half their year in the Caribbean, all expenses. But he's been replaced by Chris Marshall, from who's probably best known as the crazy one from My Family. And a lot of people were a little kind of raised eyebrows. He actually seems to be quite good at it, though. I was surprised at how good he was, to be honest with you. So hopefully they're going to get another series out of it, at least. That isn't my recommendation, though. I feel a bit guilty maybe jumped in on James. Do you want to do your recommendation?
I don't mind. It's up to you.
Okay, well, I'll carry on and do mine then.
Go ahead.
I've got a few recommendations, actually. You may or may not know this. This is a podcast of Casterbus Revelations, isn't it? Casterbus has a sister called Cult Britannia, which kind of stops and starts as I sort of work and get bogged down in things. Thankfully, I've been picking up some very good writers over the last few weeks. And thanks to one of them, with Darren Curley, we're doing a lot more content at the moment, a lot more news content. And it turns out, by all means, one of my recommendations is to go to cultbritannia.co.uk. And if you're a fan of British cult TV, Cult Britannia has TV, movies, books, and we're now doing music as well. If you are a fan of The Professionals, it has been announced in the last week that there is a brand new remastered HD box set coming out later this year, which is very exciting for me personally. I've seen the remaster comparisons and it's really, really good. So that's my kind of recommendation. That's my main recommendation. But I will say, I'm going to give you kind of preemptive on my recommendations, because one of my clients gave me a £50 birthday bonus, which I thought was really nice of them. So I spent it on Doctor Who DVDs that I didn't have. The list may surprise you, but being someone who grew up with satellite TV, it perhaps shouldn't do. So over the next few weeks, I'm probably going to be recommending The Curse of Fenric, Colony in Space, Remembrance of the Daleks, The Sunmakers, The Time Monster, Underworld, and The Horns of Nimon.
No, you won't.
Why won't?
Not The Horns of Nimon.
Or maybe The Extras.
I like that one.
Yeah, that's the... I'm going to hold my hands up now. I am guilty as charged. I haven't seen The Curse of Fenric since 1989.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And considering how much I enjoyed it, that is a surprise. Remembrance of the Daleks, I haven't seen since I sold the Dalek tin for a nice amount of money before Kerry and I got married and paid for someone's dinner on the wedding day. And Horns of Nimon, I haven't seen since 1979. Underworld and Time Monster and Sunmakers, and Colony in Space, I haven't seen.
Well, I was like that with Colony in Space. And I know, actually, I was like that with all of those, I think, because I got them in the last year or so. So I've said in the recommendations, I think, Underworld, I've mentioned. And
yeah. Well, I was looking at the gaps on my shelf, and I've got Amazon Prime as well, which was an accident. I think I might have mentioned that a few weeks ago. So I get free postage on stuff for a ridiculously short. I was waiting outside, waiting for the Amazon drone to come, basically, and deliver these. As it was an Amazon drone in a van who walked out halfway up my path and tried to push the gate the wrong way. Moron. If I was going for Pertwee, I wanted the Master, because there's an entire series of the Master, and then there's a few other episodes, and you can't get enough Roger Delgado, so I had to have the Master in there. So
yeah,
I'm very pleased with my choice. I'm going to be even more pleased, and I am going to be pleased with Nimon as well. Whatever you say.
We'll see.
Okay, so then my recommendations really cool, Britannia, but that's a little kind of a preview into my future recommendations, basically. So, James.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to keep the avid listener who's been waiting with bated breath, hands down trousers or whatever, however an excited...
What? I was having a drink, Ted.
Well... I'm glad you were, because then before we know that your hands were not down trousers, but were holding a cup. The Flames of Cadiz, which I mentioned last week, I've still not finished. But that sounds insane. But, you know, once we used to have one episode per week, that's how it goes, you know. And I like to let things roll out. What I've watched in the last 2 days was, and this is actually quite a big recommendation for me. So I'm sorry if I do my usual too long, didn't read in audio form. But it was Death to the Daleks, which was the very first VHS of Doctor Who that I got when I must have been, 10 or 11, when they came out in 1999. Yeah. I know they had been previously had a Revenge of the Cybermen and I think the Five Doctors out for like £20 mark before that. But the first budget ones that came out, Death to the Daleks was one of them. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting that and I was about 10 or 11. And apart from Doctor Who is in Sylvester McCoy or whoever at the time, there wasn't really that many repeats. So it was kind of exciting. And I was very excited when it started up and Death to the Daleks starts off with the old vortex tunnel, which I hadn't seen in like 10 years as a kid. And well, obviously not 10 years. Obviously, so I was only about 10. Okay, so I must have been about 14 now. I don't know. It was the late 80s. Must be about 14. So, yeah, but that was, yeah. And I remember kept rewinding and watching that bit. So rewatching Death to the Daleks now was very interesting for me because it carries a very special relevance to me.
It is odd when you see it for the first time, isn't it? John Pertwee's body flying through the time tunnel.
Yes.
The TARDIS. You're used to that TARDIS.
You would think when you first see it, you'd think that surely the head, because we see the head so often, and even Patrick Troughton had the head, you would think the head would be logical. But no, someone thought the full body going down the vortex would be the better move. And I suppose you can see the logic there. A disembodied head could...
Also, as the position of his arms, it does look slightly funereal.
Yes. It is... he looks a bit like... the shape his body's in, because his legs are so tightly together that you've got the cape and then the head. It's almost something like you'd imagine to see in a vicarage as a wooden shape on the wall of some saint. It's a really weird choice. But anyway, yeah, so that was very memorable for me. But watching it, it's an interesting episode because it does tend to get quite badly panned.
Yeah.
And I've never quite understood why. I came back thinking, you know, am I going to watch this? And is it just the nostalgia of it being the very first Doctor Who that I owned on tape that's going to carry this for me? And it's not. I think it is a really good story. It's got all those standard tropes of Terry Nation, which I know some people would say.
I think that's one of the problems with it, is that it does, when you compare it with the others, it does seem to be a kind of a repeat. And
well, you've got
I think perhaps Barry Letts and Terence Dicks were more than aware of this when they came, because it was them that commissioned Genesis, wasn't it?
Yes.
They wanted something different with Genesis, that they didn't want Terry Nation. I think it's even written in one of the books somewhere that they didn't want him to send in the same script again.
Which he did, essentially, if I recall rightly, and they sort of called him up
initially,
and
sort of
said, yeah, well, you know, we've had this before. And even, I think they say even in Death of the Daleks...
We've had this 12 times.
...was initially meant to be a jungle planet again, which just happened to be the last episode of the Daleks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a few leftovers from that script in the Death of the Daleks. The bowl, there's a few things like the boulder coming down, I think, was one of the ideas from the jungle script was removed. And there's loads of little tropes which are quite, some quite direct lifts, like the Sarah comes out of the TARDIS and is scared by a petrified object. Mm. There's you've got the primitives, which harks back very much to Planet of the Daleks. There's a lot of things in there that are quite familiar, but it still works. The Daleks, it's one of those ones, it's like Day of the Daleks. It's not a particularly good Dalek story, but it is a very well-paced story.
I think weakening the Daleks and giving them a challenge is an interesting thing.
But they didn't weaken them for too long. And in some respects, they are very weak, to a point where, like Ewoks with Stormtroopers, a few bashes over the head and they blow up. And one just self-destructs because he's forgotten to make the coffee. It's weird. But it is a very interesting story. It's very different. The music is fantastic in it. And if you get the DVD, you get the isolated film track.
I think one of the reasons score. I didn't like it many years ago was because of the soundtrack.
It is very unusual.
It is. I think I was more along the line. I've kind of felt that it trivialised the Daleks a bit. And this during a time of the show when it wasn't on, and they had been quite trivialised over the years. Far more recently, that kind of jarred with me a bit.
But it's very powerful in the original moments with the score, with the scoring of the first episode, which is a very good first episode, which as usual is Dalek Light. Mm. And it's a setting of them on a weird planet and some really lovely scoring for there. But I know what you mean when there's a motif that they keep introducing when a Dalek appears, and it's sort of a do. It's sort of like you would imagine in a Carry On film, and it's lumbering and it sounds vaguely silly. So I take that point. It's not perfect in any way.
No.
Visually, it works in every way. The monsters, the Exelons are really well rendered. The Daleks, of course, are good. The city is well rendered. It's a beautiful model shot of the city. The opening's great. I love the little bit they mentioned in the commentary when the TARDIS lands, it crashes, and they had three stunt prop men inside wobbling the box to make it look like it was shaking as it lands. And it's a really I still think it's underrated. I think Pertwee's very good in it as well. He plays a very solid, his usual solid serious performance. And the one thing I will just finally say that I found really, I found quite eerie as a kid, because I hadn't seen Pertwee for years properly. And there's a bit at the beginning where Sarah says, I'm going to go in and get changed. You won't go anywhere. And he's sort of course I won't. I'll be right here. And as soon as she goes in, he just wanders off. Now, I mean, he's just obviously meant to be just too preoccupied and wanders off. But as a kid, that was quite shocking. It was quite harsh and dark that, you know, the way he just wanders off and leaves her. I don't know why that worked, and I love the crank to open the doors of the TARDIS. It's a good, very cheap. It's pretty cheap now to buy, and yes, it was interesting to revisit my memories, and it's got a good load of features and a nice about 30 minutes of studio recording that's on there, and some nice clips.
Of course, that was these bits of that on the more than 30 years in the TARDIS, didn't they?
Yeah, and they've got some cuts of the Daleks Hammer film. Which they've got on the DVD as well.
Right.
Which has got a lovely shot of Roy Castle and Peter Cushing doing a little dance routine. Which, you know, the thing of Peter Cushing doing any dance routine is quite fascinating. I was going to say, it's good stuff.
Actually, if you're a fan of Peter Cushing, there's a very good website, isn't there? I found it through Facebook. Like a Peter Cushing Facebook page. I'm going to put that in the show notes. Anyone who's a fan of Peter Cushing should be aware of that.
I was going to say, I remember it being a good story when I saw it. I just remember my only issue, and I don't remember if this was dealt with within the story now I'm saying it, but everything technology-wise just kind of like stopped working there, so everybody was kind of bows and arrows, and the only thing that stopped on the Daleks was their guns instead of their mobility.
Mm. They do make a comment about that. I mean, I noticed on it. Well, I know I knew it, but he makes a comment. The Doctor says it's because they use psychokinetic powers.
That's right.
But then later on, he pulls out his sonic screwdriver and starts using it on one of the traps. which is interesting. So assuming that must be also psychokinetic, which some people have argued with the latest screwdrivers that maybe they are, that there is some sort of, because obviously there's no buttons or anything, you just seem to make it do a lot of different things. I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's no readout. You know, I've always made the argument that they were, you know, he had a psychic connection with it, in many, much the same way that he has like a telepathic link with the TARDIS. You know, the way, for instance, Eccleston or Matt Smith or even Tennant all do readings and say that they see certain things. It was always just to me that I think there's some kind of visual readout that he can see that we can't, or there's some kind of mental information that's going feeding directly into his brain. The way that I think that it works, so maybe, who knows,
maybe it's like Google Glass.
But you do have the thing where Smith tells Clara to put the device in the sonic charger on the console, so you know, maybe it doesn't just run on psychokinesis, or maybe you need to charge that,
maybe when he uses it in the show he uses it within the actual city, and maybe the city draws power from outside it, and inside it you do have standard power. Maybe that's the way. But yes, it's yeah, getting back, it is an unusual, I think it's always very funny the way that post Planet of the Daleks, the Daleks stories are quite interesting because they force Terry Nation to not do what he wants to do, and that's phone in another Dalek story.
Yeah.
I mean, they mention in the commentary how he, during that period of Death of the Daleks, he had his 39th birthday, and it was at his mansion, which of course was paid for largely by the Daleks. It just shows how much money the Daleks made him, and how, you know, he was pretty much phoning in, or trying to, not in a nasty way, but he probably was just phoning in scripts if he could.
Well, we've got an interview with Terry Nation coming this weekend, which celebrates
it's
the
so
50th.
Embarrassing. He's going to be so angry to hear me say that.
It celebrates the 50th anniversary of the end of the Dalek series, serial. This weekend, it's 50 years since that ended. So we've got an archive interview by Dave Rudin from an old fanzine from the 1980s with Terry Nation. So that'd be interesting. Nice little link we've got there to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K.
One final amendment, actually, which is reference to the previous podcast where we talked about Peter Cushing film. I was talking to the gent that I work with. On video games, and he was clarifying, because he listened to the podcast last week, and he was saying and he probably will this week because he seems to like to pull me up on things. He was saying that the because we talked about how with the Cushing films, how they could do stuff with the Daleks without the BBC, and he was sort of saying he says the license for the Cushing films will be that Hammer can do absolutely anything it wants with Doctor Who within the very tight frame of that story.
Right.
So they can use the TARDIS, the police box, the Daleks. They could license anything they wanted with that, but they couldn't go outside that framework. If they went outside that framework, BBC would be on top of them.
Mm.
It was something we were questioning. We weren't sure, were we? So there we go.
Okay. Thank you for that. Nice little addendum there at the end. Mm-hmm. And that's it for this week. We'll be back next time. Thank you for listening in your droves, Casterbus listeners. Bye-bye.